Welcome to the Hutchmoot Podcast, brought to you by the Rabbit Room Podcast Network. If you're wondering what in the world a Hutchmoot is, you are not alone. Let me give you the short version. Hutchmoot is an annual arts conference hosted by the Rabbit Room in which we gather people together around art, music, story, and faith. If you want the long version, check out the website at hutchmoot.com, where all of your questions, or at least some of them, will be answered. What is it that makes ghost stories so much fun? Is it just that they're scary and suspenseful and make us jump? Or is it something deeper? What if these eerie tales of things that go bump in the night are actually lifting the veil and shining light on something real and good and true about the world? In this episode, Andrew Peterson, singer-songwriter, author, poet, and, full disclosure, my brother, investigates these questions and tries to get at the heart of why these stories fill us with such a delightful shiver.
I want to make a few disclaimers. This session is not an attempt to convince you to like ghost stories. So just to get that out of the way, if you don't like ghost stories, that is totally fine. You may even have solid theological reasons for not liking them, and that is also fine. It's a matter of conscience, I think. So we're not going to try to, like, you know, push you in any direction. This session is just an attempt by those of us who do like them to understand why. Some people love swing dancing. I don't. Some people love sushi. I actually do. Some people actually love the delightful shiver of a ghost story, and I am one of those people. Jamie and I are different in so many ways. One way is that if there is something weird, I always want to check it out. If someone told me there was a ghost in the next room, I would be the first one to volunteer. Jamie, on the other hand, would run like Scooby-Doo all the way to her parents' house in Florida and then turn on every light in the house. But at the same time, she's the one who, like, if anybody brings up, like, oh yeah, they say that house is haunted, she's just like, what? She'll back away from the story physically because she's freaked out. One thing that illustrates the difference between Jamie and I pretty well is the time that we saw a UFO on the side of the interstate. We were driving, I forget where, in Georgia or something. There was this heavy mist hanging over the interstate at night. And we both just looked up and saw a full-on flying saucer hovering next to the interstate. And I was like, oh my word, there's a... And I slammed on the brakes and pulled over, and she said, go! It was a water tower. It was a water tower. For sure. And if there was a UFO, I was going in it. She was like, are you crazy? Get out of here. We probably got in like a little wedding spat or a marriage spat on the way home. Like, honey, Pete, you may have heard this about Pete, but my brother, whenever they put out the call for people who are willing to go colonize Mars, Pete was like, totally gonna do it. And Jennifer was like, you can't do that. What if we have children by then? Whatever. And so they got in kind of a funny argument because, and he said he had to sneakily volunteer for that. He would be the one chosen. Anyway. So my brother and I, on the other hand, have always wanted to believe that the world is full of mystery. We want aliens to be real. We want there to be monsters under the bed and have always wanted it so. Pete sends me Bigfoot articles from time to time. I roll my eyes and he says, well, of course I don't believe in Bigfoot. But you got to see this website. Have you seen this? Like saying, oh, rationally, yeah, but I got to show you this thing over here. So who wouldn't want there to be some official Yeti discovery that blows the mind of the world scientists? I think we all would. Another quick story about Pete and I, the fact that he's kind of got this conspiracy theorist side of him. One night late, I always kind of go outside before bed, you know, because the kids and Jamie are always in bed first, and we live on some property, so I was kind of like, go check everything out, make sure before I lock up, and I was in my boxers, maybe a t-shirt, and I kind of stepped outside, and I heard a sound coming from the woods at the top of the hill that sounded like that, like almost like a buck snort, you know, the sound deer make. But it sounded kind of like that sound, but it was going on consistently, and it was kind of echoing over the hill in the night, you know, and I was kind of like, this is creepy. And it sounded kind of like somebody shoveling gravel. Like, it was that regular, and I was like, Nobody should be up there shoveling gravel. So I kind of start walking up the hill, you know, and I've got my phone with me, and I'm kind of like shining, and I'm getting closer and closer. I get to the edge of the trees. I'm like, I'm near the wall, and whatever was making the sound was right in the darkness inside the trees. And I was like, this is so, like, what would that possibly be? I couldn't think of what animal would make that noise. And so I looked down the hill, and my brother lives next door, and I saw that his light was on. So I call him. It's like 1 in the morning. He goes, hello? And I said, hey, I think there's an alien in the woods. And he goes, I'll be right there. So like seconds later, I see his phone like shining up. Two Peterson brothers are standing there at the edge of the woods, and we're like talking, and our dog is standing. And another weird thing was that the dog was not barking at it. And I was like, what's going on with that? So anyway, I finally gave up waiting. I threw a stick in the woods, and something made a big, loud crashing noise and ran away. And the end of the story is that I told this some farmers in our who lived around me. I was telling them that story, and they all were kind of like nodding knowingly while I was telling the story. And I was like, you guys know what this was? And they were like, yes, it was 2 wild boars. Making babies. And I was like, really? And they were like, yeah, that's the sound that they make. And I was like, well, why wouldn't the dog have chased him? They were like, well, the dog knows better than to interrupt. The boars are so violent, I guess, you know? Anyway. So the point is, Pete and I are eager to know, like, what's, like, what if there is a mystery, we want to know about it. Okay, so back to the thing. So I'm one of those people, I have no idea why. Maybe it was the Southern Gothic vibe of my little town in Florida, where Spanish moss hung from the live oaks that crowded the moonlit church steeple outside my window. Maybe it was early memories of Disney World and the Haunted Mansion, which is the ride I still can't miss. Maybe it was watching The Ghost of Mr. Chicken, or Transylvania 65,000, or Young Frankenstein. Maybe it was Edgar Allan Poe's The Raven, which we read in school, which led me to Telltale Heart, and The Cask of Amontillado, and The Murders in the Rue Morgue. Halloween was another big one for me. Back when we lived in small town Illinois, we trick-or-treated every year, carved pumpkins, ate gobs of candy. I dressed up as Captain America one year, which meant that I wandered the streets with a trash can lid for a shield and my underoos for a costume. This was last year. Another year, I wrapped my arms and legs in tinfoil and told people I was R2-D2. My parents had a glow-in-the-dark cardboard skeleton that they hung from the front door of the church parsonage, and no one ever thought to complain about it. My favorite thing was a little cardstock haunted house, which we still have, that we put together each year, complete with bats, cobwebs, ghosts, witches, vampires, coffins, spiders, mummies, and funny headstones. It was like Santa Claus, all done in good fun. And I was never confused about what good and evil really was, or about whether this stuff was in conflict with the Bible stories we always read. Indeed, the Bible was much more frightening than any of the ghost stories. And since in the Bible there was an obvious supernatural reality in every story, and those stories were, according to my parents and my own intuition, true, the fact that once a year we had fun with made-up supernatural tales seemed as ordinary as Star Wars or Captain America or Narnia. In Nashville, as in most cities, there are these awful terror warehouses that show up, you know, where people pay to walk through a gory, demonic maze to get grossed out and horrified. That, for me, crosses a line. And that line, I suppose, is part of what we're here to talk about. Ghost story can mean a lot of things. What I don't mean by it is horror, which I usually think of in the context of horror films like Friday the 13th, Nightmare on Elm Street, and Scream. And in those films, and in some Stephen King books, that kind of stuff, there's an explicitness to the horror which leaves little to the imagination. They have more to do with what you see than what you don't see. People jump, they scream, they spill their popcorn, they see acts of murder and gore. I don't have time to make a case for it, but I doubt very seriously that this kind of thing is edifying. Although it's arguable that it depends on the context. I won't even comment on what some call gore porn, attempts to get as dark and evil and visceral as possible, like what I've heard about the Saw franchise, for which I don't think there's any excuse. For that matter, I'm not really talking about films at all, because they work on the imagination in such a different way from books. Ghost stories, particularly Victorian ghost stories, or at least stories that come from that tradition, tend to be marked by a few key characteristics in varying degrees, and I'm going to kind of go through the things that I notice, the things that I look for and love about a certain kind of ghost story. In the first one is atmosphere. In C.S. Lewis's essay On Stories, he talks about how crucial atmosphere is to storytelling. That, along with Tolkien's On Fairy Stories, had a lot to do with my attempt to make Ere We Are in my own books as authentic a world as I could by populating it with weird creatures and cultures. I think it's best when the story grows out of the setting. A Canadian writer named Brenton Dickinson wrote, On Stories, the C.S. Lewis essay, is now recognized to contain some of the earliest critical thinking about fantasy writing and is a precursor to the study of story and atmosphere as important to literature. The atmosphere idea is pretty intriguing, he says. The most important part of a story is not its plot, or in a romance or adventure story, its ability to create excitement. Lewis explains, if to love story is to love excitement, then I ought to be the greatest lover of excitement alive. But the fact is that what is said to be the most exciting novel in the world, The Three Musketeers, makes no appeal to me at all. The total lack of atmosphere repels me. There is no country in the book, save as a storehouse of inns and ambushes. There's no weather. When they cross to London, there is no feeling that London differs from Paris. So a good ghost story writer goes to great pains to create a strong sense of place. In M.R. James's A Whistle and I'll Come to You, My Lad, which I'm sure you're going to talk about, right? Are you going to read any of it?
No, you go ahead.
Okay, so M.R. James, really quick, I'm going to pause, is kind of regarded as the master of the Victorian ghost story. He was I think, Christian. He was Anglican, at least. His dad was a rector, right? And he was a student of, what was his official title? He taught at Cambridge, and he taught, like, scripture, basically. He was, like, an Old Testament scholar and wrote a lot of commentaries, like that. But for fun, he wrote ghost stories, and they got collected into these stories that just kind of, like, caught on. And he became known mostly for being a great ghost story writer. So this is I bought this in England, the collected stories of M.R. James. I'm looking for a first edition, but they cost like $3,000. Anyway, his most famous ghost story is called Oh, Whistle and I'll Come to You, My Lad, which is a crazy title. But write it down. You can find it for free online because it's public domain by now. Oh, Whistle and I'll Come to You, My Lad. It takes maybe 20 minutes to read it, maybe 25 minutes to read it. We've read it as a family around Halloween many years. The kids love that story. I'm just going to give you a pitch. He's so good at atmosphere. Like, he spends so much time conjuring the setting of the story. So just to give you an example. Okay, where is it? Okay, so this is just two sentences, I think. Bleak and solemn was the view. I can't do it in which I said. Bleak and solemn was the view on which he took a last look before starting homeward. A faint yellow light in the west showed the golf links, on which a few figures moving toward the clubhouse were still visible. The squat Martello Tower, the lights of Aldsey Village, the pale ribbon of sands intersected at intervals by black wooden groins, which are these kind of like buffers on the beach, the dim and murmuring sea. The wind was bitter from the north, but was at his back when he set out for the Globe Inn. I just love the way he paints the picture. The whole story is like that. Atmosphere is the better part of a good ghost story. The same is true of mysteries. I suppose you could write a story about a detective trying to solve a murder in the suburbs, but wouldn't you rather read one about a murder on a stony island off the coast of Maine in the middle of a hurricane that disrupts the ferry service, so all the suspects are trapped there for the weekend? Atmosphere is closely linked to the second characteristic, which is dread. When the protagonist is bumbling along in his or her materialistic obliviousness, but we know that they're heading toward a frightening encounter with mystery, the dramatic irony is delicious. It keeps us turning pages. One of my favorite books in the world, The Yearling, surprised me with its dread. I usually tell people right out of the gate that the deer dies at the end, because it makes the experience of the story better. It's like telling kids who watch The Sound of Music, don't worry, there's a whole Nazi escape scene at the end. It's the only part of that movie I liked when I was a kid. But knowing as a reader that the characters are moving slowly but inevitably toward a reckoning, an encounter with something they don't understand, this gives our imaginations room to wonder what's going to happen as we creep closer and closer to the sharing of the terrifying vision with the protagonist. This, again, is different from a typical horror film in that we hardly see anything until the very end, and even then it's usually just a glimpse. The point is not what we see as much as the fact that the character has seen it. In M.R. James's Canon Alberic scrapbook, which is another really good one, all we see at the end is a hairy hand resting on the desk beside the main character while he's writing. And it's enough to give me the heebie-jeebies. A hand wouldn't be effective if there had been no persistent dread. So third, there's revelation, which I already touched on. A good ghost story contains a moment of apocalypse for the protagonist, where he or she realizes some truth about the world that upsets their preconceptions. They are forced for the rest of their lives to admit that the world is bigger than they thought. Because the Enlightenment drove, and you're going to talk about this, the Enlightenment drove a wedge between reason and imagination. Many Victorian writers, many of whom were Christians, or at least theists, pushed back at materialism by writing fairy tales and ghost stories in which the natural world is invaded or interrupted by the supernatural. Everyone from Poe to Arthur Conan Doyle to George MacDonald to Rudyard Kipling wrote stories about the supernatural in an age when reason was meant to have eradicated such foolish notions. A common trope of these tales is the atheistic, materialistic protagonist who thinks that only superstitious fools believe in a spiritual world, and then he or she has an encounter that upsets their worldview. Clichés are clichés for a reason. It's effective, and it happens to be especially fun to read about that moment of reckoning when that protagonist realizes they don't know as much as they think they do. The most famous ghost story, probably, is Charles Dickens' Christmas Carol, or at least here in America, maybe in England too. Scrooge doesn't believe in Christmas, which is to say, he doesn't believe in Christ. Nothing matters to him but money. It doesn't get much more materialistic than that. His revelation isn't really that there are spirits, because he seems to accept it early on by having his conversation with Jacob Marley. His revelation is that he is a terrible person. And I don't know about you, but when I was a kid, the two parts I most wanted to see were Scrooge's redemption at the end. Who doesn't feel something when he's so full of joy the next morning? And before that, his encounter with the ghost of Christmas yet to come. All the gaiety of the other ghosts was boring to me. I wanted to be scared, creeped out, and I knew, even as a boy, that something about the terror that Scrooge felt was a necessary step towards his redemption the next morning. In her academic book, The Victorian Ghost Story, by a Swiss theologian named Zoe Lehmann-Imfeld, she takes this a step further, and she claims that in many of these stories, the characters actually move from a non-orthodox position to one that is profoundly Christian. They realize, she argues, that they are fallen creatures. In other words, they are wrong about the world. In various ways, she says, the characters rely on the voices of Christian orthodoxy for guidance towards redemption from their desperate positions. The outcome for each protagonist is tightly bound to their ability to recognize themselves as fallen and desperate beings. As long as the characters disbelieve in the reality of God, and therefore the reality of their own need for him, they are, in a sense, only half creatures. In a sense, they are only half human, because they refuse to acknowledge their own divine image and therefore their own fallenness, which means that in some senses, the human is the one who is haunting the ghost story, the protagonist, because they are not fully aware of the entirety of the world, of the fullness of the supernatural and the physical. The way it all works together, they're the ones that are haunting the real world because they're only half, they have a half-formed imagination, which I think is a crazy insight. So a ghost story is seen to be haunted not by an unknown demon, but by man as fallen. It is the protagonist that haunts the real world and the spiritual reality of it as a spectral being. Once they accept the reality of God, they, in a sense, stop being ghosts and take on flesh. She says, in the Victorian ghost story, the human condition in its basis state, as without God, takes horrific physical form and appears in order to remind the protagonist that they are on a theological journey. The characters are haunted by a shadow of the worst of themselves. M.R. James's characters are neither seeking nor expecting revelation, and thus, when faced with their own individual apocalypses, are not equipped to encounter the experience as anything other than the late modern apocalypse of horrific and complete destruction. The theology of M.R. James's supernatural tales reveals all the moral complexities of the fallen human condition when no longer anchored in Christian orthodoxy. If we accept M.R. James's ghost stories as inherently theological, and moreover theologically complex, then we begin to see them as fascinating discussions of theological anthropology, in which the frailty of the human condition is exposed as providing the real terror to the tales. That's really dense. I know that's a lot, but just trust me, it's awesome. So it is the humans who deny the existence of God who haunt the stories. The final necessary characteristic is repositioning, which is a word and an idea that I got from her book, too. If the main character in the story is on a journey from disbelief to belief, a belief that is thrust upon them by their own arrogance and or ignorance, then the reader is following suit, whether he or she knows it or not. By the very act of reading a ghost story, we are engaging our imaginations in a way that moves us closer to accepting the possibility that there is a spiritual world. In Imfeld's words, why, however, should this experience be understood within the terms of theology? The answer is the double confrontation of the supernatural event. The haunted protagonist of the story and the reader, likewise, are confronted with the possibility of the supernatural and the actuality of the supernatural at the same time. This event points not only to a transcendence of the imminent frame, but suggests that this transcendence has already taken place. The reader has been repositioned. The supernatural event, she writes, expands the frame to allow for the possibility of a theological meta-narrative. I'll say that again. The supernatural event in the ghost story expands the frame to allow for the possibility of a theological meta-narrative. This calls to mind Lewis's idea of subversion in stories. They allow the truth to sneak past watchful dragons. Which is to say that when a person is reading a ghost story, if someone who is an atheist is reading a ghost story, by the very act of reading that ghost story, they're engaging with something that has the potential to broaden their imagination and allow for the possibility that there is a theological narrative that they are within the framework of. Does that make sense? It's pretty amazing. So it happens to the character in the ghost story, but it happens to you while you're reading it as well. So one of my favorite stories in the Bible is in 2 Kings chapter 6. I'm going to read it to you. So the king of Syria sent there horses and chariots and a great army, and they came by night and surrounded the city. When the servant of the man of God, Elisha, rose early in the morning and went out, behold, an army with horses and chariots was all around the city. And the servant said, alas, my master, what shall we do? He said, don't be afraid, for those who are with us are more than those who are with them. Then Elisha prayed and said, O Lord, please open his eyes that he may see. So the Lord opened the eyes of the young man, and he saw, and behold, the mountain was full of horses and chariots of fire all around Elisha. That's awesome. There is a spiritual world. It's all around us all the time. And Elisha prayed that he would see it. God lifts the veil and he sees that there's more going on than we think there is. The creepiest, coolest part of that story is when Elisha says, those who are with us are more than those who are with them. Which implies that while there was a host of horses and chariots of fire, and presumably angels riding them, on God's side, there were also bad guys. Demons, maybe. I don't know what to make of it, but that story reminds me that there is, as Paul wrote, there are powers and principalities in the heavenly realms. That whole passage is amazing. When I read these stories, the ghost stories of M.R. James and others, usually in October, I am pleasantly reminded that there is indeed a supernatural battle taking place all around us. And I am able to enjoy a good ghost story because I truly believe that those who are with us are more than those who are with them. I am repositioned, even as Elisha's servant.
This concludes part one of The Delightful Shiver. Join us next time as we'll be joined by Lanier Ivester, who continues the discussion on why we love ghost stories. The Hutchmoot Podcast is brought to you by the Rabbit Room Podcast Network. Special thanks to Andrew Osinga for the use of his song Perihelion 1 from his amazing record, Leonard the Lonely Astronaut.